feels like we bumped one of these out just the other day, but it's a new week, it's a new series, there's a new opponent, and that means a brand new VanCast for you, and we have upped our game. The VIPs demand the best, and that's what we're here to provide. And we tried to book drunk Brett Hull to sing Gloria as our intro music, but couldn't make that happen, Drancer. But hey, bring on the Blues, the Canucks drawing the defending champs in round one of the playoffs, and we know that starts on Wednesday night.
Well, I'm not giving up the dream that easily. We'll have to reach out to JR, see what we can do. If we can get drunk Brett Hull on the podcast singing Gloria, I mean, we've got to do it. No, the Blues, an interesting matchup, I think, all around. I did go to that game yesterday, that Sunday game. A variety of Canucks players, like a wide variety of Canucks players, checked out at least portions of the game. Like, I'd say more than half the team, ultimately. Travis Green was there as well. So a keen interest from the Canucks as they waited to see how their matchup would be set. And if they saw that game, I hope they're not taking too much from it, because both of those teams looked like, and I want to say this tactfully, absolute dog shit. Like, that was a complete waste of a game. It was so inconsequential, the NHL barely tracked stats for it. The live in-game play-by-play had the anthem coming after about 6 minutes of play. Like, it felt like a neutral site preseason game, just a complete afterthought. And the teams played like it. Like, they were both full limited value with backup goaltenders playing, skating to not get hurt. No drama, even though there was overtime in a shootout. Other than Miro Heskinen, I don't know that a single guy broke a sweat. Just appalling. And honestly, I was standing there watching the game, and I was committed by that point. I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to watch the whole game. I'm not just going to walk out midway through a game that I've come to cover. And I just kept thinking to myself, what am I doing here, and what has my life become? Like, it was such a bad game that it made me existential about, like, where I am in the world, specifically Edmonton. Look, the one major takeaway you have to have from that game is the Canucks have now been playing an intense series for their playoff lives for 10 days. They've been in battle mode, even if they celebrated hard over the weekend. The Blues and the Stars, there's a flip that they're going to, a switch that they're going to have to flip before this series begins, or the Canucks are going to have a pretty significant advantage, especially in the early games, as the Stars or the Blues now, we know, but I think the Stars are going to have the same issue against Calgary as those two teams find, you know, their playoff footing, as it were.
Yeah, you talked about the Canucks checking out that game. Checked out was the perfect description of what both the Blues and the Stars did. And you're right. Like, I sat here on a sunny Sunday afternoon watching on TV, because obviously it had implications for the Canucks. But I'm thinking to myself, like, you know, isn't this in some ways totally fitting that, you know, the end of the round robin between two teams trying to decide the bottom seed in a bubble during a pandemic require a shootout? And looked like, as you said, like, Sagan's not playing for Dallas. Like, man, I thought the Stars were just going to go quietly and it was going to be Canucks-Dallas. But it's funny, like, one late goal and one shootout goal, and that changes the fortunes, and it changes the path, obviously, because now the Canucks take on the defending Stanley Cup champs. And I saw immediately, once the matchup was set, like, a ton of people on Twitter, you know, pumping out all sorts of remarks about the regular season series between the Canucks and the Blues. And the Canucks won two of the three matchups, and the other one they lost is probably the single greatest, not from a Canucks perspective, but just when you think of, you know, bizarre moments in this past hockey season. The Blues scoring 3-0 in overtime against Jacob Markstrom. That was the only game Markstrom faced the Blues. Demko got the win in St. Louis in October when Markstrom was on that first leave of absence and gone home to Sweden. And then they played the Blues right out of the All-Star break, first All-Star break and first All-Star game for Markstrom, and he was in St. Louis of all places, traveled back, and so Demko got that one. You know, so Jacob Markstrom has seen the Blues once. Vladimir Tarasenko played one of the three games against the Canucks.
Tarasenko just played hard, too. I've got it. You know what? You've mentioned his name, and I said only Miro Heskinen broke a sweat. Vladimir Tarasenko, to his credit, was the other guy who genuinely seemed to be playing hard all game.
You know, Michael Ferland's only goal as a Canuck came against the Blues in October. Like, that sort of tells you about the season series. Two of the three games were played a month into the season. Like, we talk about the before times and laugh. Like,
yeah.
You know how much in the before times is? Quinn Hughes was still on the second unit power play the first time the Canucks faced the Blues.
Oh, my God. Do you remember that 5-on-3? Oh, God. That 5-on-3 in St. Louis that Bo Horvat, like, scored on, but after the penalties had expired. Right. But it was, like, a full 2-minute 5-on-3, and it was just about – like, it was – there was – at the time, there was, like, 40 minutes of hockey left in the Quinn Hughes not on PP1 era. And I just remember watching that and just being like, I can't do this all season. Like, I can't. I don't think I can do this all season. It's too frustrating.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because it was, they went from St. Louis to New Jersey, and that's where they lost 1-0 in Jersey, but that's where the switch happened. Like, that's when Quinn Hughes got a portion of that game, and from that point forward, Quinn Hughes was the quarterback on the Canucks power play and will be for the next decade. And so
I still don't think we've had that adequately explained. You know, I know that in subsequent sort of months, Travis Green has been, you know, we didn't want to put too much pressure on him and on and on. But, like, that first power play practice at training camp, they knew Quinn Hughes was going to go on PP1. And I don't know if it was that Abbotsford game where the Canucks just got hot on the power play against the Arizona Coyotes, or it was the Ottawa Senators. Like, I don't know. I don't really know what happened. I don't know if it's just a overall sort of sense, just like Brock Besser had to earn his spot on PP1. Like, I don't know what happened there, but I still don't feel like I know. And it, you know, now that we're talking about it, it still bothers me. It's like one of the things about this season that still upsets me when I think about it, just because we know from the choices they made in camp that they knew that Quinn Hughes on PP1 was the most obvious fucking call of the entire season from a coaching perspective. For some reason, they decided to take 10 days to do it, or 10 games to do it. I still don't know why. As I'm getting into it now, it still bothers me, even though that's completely irrelevant to where we're at now in the playoffs with Quinn Hughes having, you know, had an absolutely lights-out season on the power play.
Right, and the explanation given was, look, if it didn't go well, people would have turned on Quinn Hughes. Like, the market would have turned. That's the explanation. I know, but
that's the explanation. But
look, you mentioned Brock Besser in the same sentence. Brock Besser didn't play his first two NHL games, remember? Like, under Travis Green, Brock Besser was a healthy scratch.
I do actually remember that, even though I was in Florida at the time.
So there have been some curious decisions off the hop. All that matters is that Quinn Hughes is on the first unit, and he's lights out now.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, so my point from the regular season, my only takeaway from the regular season is the Canucks played the Blues hard. They played them really hard. And so that should give them a little bit of confidence. But more confidence comes from the fact, as you point out, like, the Canucks are on a heater now. They won 3 in a row. The Blues have yet to win in this bubble. They have shit the bed in all of their third period. They've had a lead going to the third period in every one of their round robin games and didn't win a single one of them. So you've got the Canucks who, you know, authored this rally and this comeback on Friday. You know, they were down in the third and came back to win and are dialed in. And here are the Blues that are now trying to find their game. I'm sure the Canucks would have preferred that the series started on Tuesday just to sort of keep their mojo, but whatever, an extra day is not really going to matter here. But, you know, it's not like the Blues need rest after, I mean, that entire round robin was rest. So, you know, throw the regular season matchup and the records and that kind of stuff out the window. I will say this, that before, and I went and looked this up, before COVID, the Blues were 10-2 in their final 12 games that they played in the before times. That looked like a team that was ramping up for a defense of its Stanley Cup title. This St. Louis Blues team, who knows? I guess we'll find out a little bit more about them on Wednesday. But what an opportunity for the Canucks to get a jump in this series. Based on the way the two teams are coming into this thing.
Yes, the script that has the Canucks pulling an upset includes the Canucks getting out to a really hot start in the first two and a half, three games, right? Like, they really need to be the aggressor early on in this series, because when you look at, and it's not just the obvious effort issues that we're seeing from the Blues, like, it is also how they performed. Like, this is a team that all situations was out attempted by 57 in the three games they played. Like, that's an average of 20 per game. That's abysmal. And by shots, by 27 over three games. Like, it's hard to actually make sense of how bad you have to play to get to that point, right? Like, that's why when I said on the last episode on Saturday, like, do the Blues want to be here? Like, they need to prove that. You know, like, they've played at such a level that I think that's a fair question, just based on their on-ice performance. And look, this is a Blues team we all saw last year, right? They were, you know, near the absolute cellar of the league when the calendar flipped to 2020 or 2019, excuse me. Thank goodness it was 2019 and not 2020.
Yes.
When the calendar flipped, they were near the bottom of the league. They turned it on. They turned on the Jets like we've never seen before. Accomplished something pretty historic in terms of their climb in back into the playoffs and then right through the Western Conference, winning the Stanley Cup final against Boston in Game 7. Amazing, an amazing story. But they are going to have to do something similar again. Like, I refuse to believe otherwise. This is such a weird tournament. The Blues have not looked engaged. I do think flipping the switch is going to be more difficult now. We'll see how much they want it. If they are able to be that team, you know, then they're a real contender, right? Like, they should be able to hang with with Colorado and Vegas. But if they don't, I do think there's, you know, opportunity knocking here for a young Canucks team that has this top end that's going to give the Blues trouble, right? Like, that's the other thing to remember here. Vancouver, with Pettersson and Hughes, become this completely different, actually elite team, and there's not a lot of clubs in the NHL that can hit their fastball. Like, even the Blues might have trouble with it. They outscored the... I looked this up yesterday, J-Pat. The Canucks outscored the Wild 7-2, 5-on-5, with either Quinn Hughes or Elias Pettersson on the ice. Like, that's the series. That's it. That's it. That's the series right there. That gap explains why the Canucks won in 4. The Blues are a way better team. They're a way different beast than St. Louis. They're going to be able to come at you with Pietrangelo and O'Reilly at the same time. Like, that's ridiculous. And Jordan Binnington... When Jordan Binnington doesn't want to let in a goal, it seems like he's able to will it from crossing the line. It's a pretty incredible thing to witness. But, you know, I do think that the Canucks have a real chance here. And part of the reason why, I do think, is because based on what we've seen of the Blues so far, we just don't know what we're getting. Like, they're a completely ephemeral entity. We have no idea. They're the most volatile team in this Western bracket. We just don't know what we're going to get.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned the Blues and that sort of Cinderella story that, you know, led them to the Stanley Cup. And I always think, and I know you weren't on the beat, but I'm sure you followed Elias Pettersson in his rookie season. You know, that game in December in St. Louis when Besser had the hat trick, Pettersson went off 5 points, his second 5-point night of his rookie season. And then Tarasenko on their post-game show on the radio apologized to the season ticket holders. And the next day at practice, Robert Bortuzzo and Zach Sanford, like, engaged in a fight. Like, the gloves came off and they fought. Like,
it was right before a game against the Florida Panthers. That's how I remember that so well.
Ah, okay. So, you know, like, they really were coming apart at the seams. Mm-hmm. And then, for whatever reason, they got their act together and then they got so dialed in and, you know, look, like... Once they reached the playoffs, I don't think anybody in hockey was shocked that the Blues were the team that went on this run based on the way they had played from January until April. But, man, that first half of the season, it cost them a coach. Like, they looked like they were going to unravel completely. Guys didn't seem like they were all that into it. So, you know, they got it together, and I'm sure they'll draw on some of that when talking about, you know, flipping that switch now. But, like, I look at it like this, and feel free to chop my argument, but, you know, the Canucks have just defeated a Minnesota team that was middle of the pack with them, but in some ways, I think they're St. Louis light. Like, you know, Minnesota's not heavy on talent, like top-end offensive talent. You know, we talked about the Wild and their big four on defense. I mean, the Blues, essentially, it's a big six on defense. You mentioned Pietrangelo, but, you know, it's a forest of trees on defense. And, yeah, like, you know, they're a hard, heavy team. Like, I think... In a lot of ways, playing and beating Minnesota is a great tune-up for the Vancouver Canucks to now face the St. Louis Blues team.
I agree with you. And, you know, I think there's... I know there's people who think that the round-robin teams will be at an advantage because they'll be better rested because they've had more time off between games. And because, as we've seen, like, this schedule looks pretty dense, right? The Canucks have a back-to-back. Games 3-4 are going to be back-to-back. Like, that's tough. You know, and I do think we saw, for example, Jacob Markstrom look fatigued in that fourth game. Like, I think that was a big factor in his struggles, you know, in that game, which the Canucks ultimately sort of came back and won. So, you know, I can see that point, but I just think if you didn't approach this the way Colorado did, right? Like, Colorado looked focused and determined and hungry in this round-robin tournament. The Vegas Golden Knights, they looked like they were playing with their food, right? They just let, they spotted teams some leads, and then they took over the game to an absurd degree and just did that willful Vegas, we can manhandle opponents when we turn it on thing. And either way, they seemed like they were engaged and interested anyway in sort of doing what they were doing. St. Louis, Dallas, I mean, Dallas might have other problems, but St. Louis, it just looked like they were treating this game like a tune-up. I cannot sort of get to the point where I think that that makes sense, and we're just going to have to see whether they can turn it on. You give them the benefit of the doubt based on what they accomplished, but they cannot, like, I really struggle to see how they come out of the gates with the same level of intensity that the Canucks will have just because of what they've gone through over the last 10 days versus what the Blues have. I'm really skeptical that the Blues are going to be able to start this series on time. I still think they'll be able to win it. But, you know, I think those first two games, I really struggle to understand how the Canucks will not have an advantage in the first 120 or so minutes of hockey in this series, just based on the format of this tournament.
When you look at the Blues lineup, you know, if they're completely healthy, Shen between Tarasenko and Schwartz is their top line, O'Reilly on their second line, Perron on the one side, Sanford on the other. You know, they got a third line that has Tyler Bozek, a veteran, Robert Thomas.
Yeah, Robert Thomas is amazing too.
Sammy Blais got injured, but Craig Berube said after the game that they thought he would be fine. You know, and then you're looking at a fourth line of Sundqvist, McKechnie, and Steen. Like, it's hard to poke holes in that forward group, right? Like, again, you know, Tarasenko can be a game breaker. Only played 10 regular season games, so the layoff obviously helped him get back and available here. But, you know, when I think of the Blues, I just think of that grove of trees on defense. Pietrangelo, Parayko, Vince Dunn, Justin Falk, they pick up Scandella, Carl Gunnarsson. Like, you know, again, when they're on, and that's the question, is can they get on? How yeah. quickly can they get on? But when they're on, you know, it's just, I don't... Right. I just don't see a weakness there.
No, me
and, you know, if Ryan O'Reilly is going to get the assignment of trying to, you know, shadow Elias Pettersson, you talked about Pettersson, and we know that he can be a game breaker, but, you know, there are a few
That's
better.
A tough assignment.
Yeah. Few in the league better at the two way game than Ryan O'Reilly.
Yeah. No, it would be a massively difficult assignment were Pettersson to, you know, have to battle Ryan O'Reilly. But that's the playoffs, right? Like, that's going to be. That's not going to be a matchup that I think Pettersson himself would be nervous about or worried about, right? I think that's the fun of it, right? That's where you get to try your hand at playing, you know, meaningful games against a player of that quality, right? Like, that's sort of what this is all about. I don't think he'd be cowed by that. I think it'd be exciting. And look, I mean, Ryan O'Reilly is an absolute monster, right? Like, just a monster of a defensive player. Wins every draw. Like, he's not an easy matchup, no question. But, you know, I think that's, again, I think that's the fun of it. And then, you know, the real thing that I think, the real edge that St. Louis would have is when you have a Robert Thomas, a player like Robert Thomas on your third line, right? I mean, if that's the player going up head-to-head against Virtanen, Sutter, and Roussel, that's a pretty tall order. Like, in terms of which matchup I'd be more worried about if I'm the Canucks, it's the minutes when Robert Thomas plays, you know, against that third line, as opposed to how well Pettersson will stack up against O'Reilly. Like, I think O'Reilly is a brutal matchup for Pettersson, but at the very least, you know, I think that's a matchup the Blues are concerned about too, as opposed to, you know, their eyes lighting up as they sort of, you know, tie the napkin around their neck. You know, that's sort of how I'd worry about this matchup. The Blues have better depth. Like, the Blues should be by rights the best, or certainly one of the best teams in the Western Conference, in this Western bracket. I just look at it though, and with how this tournament has shaped up, you know, it's tough for me to think that you know, that they're not a question mark, right? Like, no one's talking about them the way we're talking about Vegas and Colorado. I think that's for good reason. And hey, look, okay, so I just pulled it up just out of curiosity. 16 and a half head-to-head minutes between Ryan O'Reilly and Elias Pettersson was not probably Pettersson's primary matchup among St. Louis centermen, but not by a wide margin. The Canucks outshot the Blues in that matchup 12-4 head-to-head, and it was scoreless overall. But you like that shot margin, right?
Yep.
Looks like Pettersson fared pretty well in that matchup in the regular season. But again, we do know, like, the Canucks did play the Blues tough, right? So, but one of the reasons they did is it looks like head-to-head anyway, when given a chance to play Ryan O'Reilly, you know, that's a matchup that, first of all, yeah, so O'Reilly was Pettersson's primary matchup, and that's a matchup that worked out pretty well for the Canucks.
Yeah, and look, we've talked about, you know, can St. Louis find its game? Like, that is sort of the storyline for me coming into this thing, but I just put this out there for our listeners to remember. Before COVID hit, the St. Louis Blues were the top seed in the Western Conference. Like, they were the top seed. They have fallen in this round robin, but they entered the tournament as the number one seed for a reason. So just remember that, even though they're not on their game. We'll talk more about the Canucks top line here in a sec, but got to mention that support for the VanCast is brought to you by Manscaped, which is known for being the best in man's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. I see they've got a TV budget, too. I was watching the Golf Channel over the weekend. I saw an ad for Manscaped, the 3.0 lawnmower. And Manscaped just launched in Canada. For those listeners in this country, you can be one of the first Canadians to experience their life-changing products. That's why Manscaped has redesigned the electric trimmer. The Manscaped engineering team has perfected the greatest trimmer ever created and have their new and improved Lawnmower 3.0. So check it out. And here's a little bit more for you. You can get 20% off and free shipping with the code THEATHLETIC20 at manscaped.com. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code THEATHLETIC20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And use the code THEATHLETIC20. And for a limited time, subscribers get not one but two free gifts. The Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value, and the patented high-performance anti-chafing Manscaped Boxer Brief. So go to manscaped.com today and use the code THEATHLETIC20. We were talking about the Canucks top line. You know, for me to answer, like, I'm almost encouraged by the fact that they were good in lots of moments in that series against Minnesota, but I do think that there's more to give. Like, JT Miller wasn't his dominant self. Elias Pettersson was really good for lots of stretches, but didn't really ever take over a game where you walked away and said, hands down, he was the best player on the ice. And the longer it goes, the more chances that Pettersson gets to be that guy. So the Canucks take care of the Wild in four. They win three straight. Their best players, you know, were their best players, but I still think there's room to grow and to give for those best players.
Yeah, and you know, a weird statistical quirk is that Pettersson and Hughes were both excellent, right? Like, the underlying data by the eye test, they were both excellent, but in the minutes that they were together, they didn't seem to do that force enhancer thing that they usually do, where they sort of push that the Canucks to another gear. They played about 26 minutes together, 5-on-5. It wasn't their best 26 minutes. Like, they were better apart in that Wild series for whatever reason. Just and again, just small sample statistical quirk. But that, to me, suggests that we really haven't seen the best out of the Canucks 5-on-5 in this series because, you know, again, they outscored the Blues by a wide margin, 7-2, in minutes where one of Pettersson or Hughes were on the ice. But in the minutes that they were together, it was 1-1, right? Like, that was not sort of the moments in which the Canucks really made the difference count in this series. So yeah, I do think the Canucks top end has another gear. And then for Pettersson specifically, it's kind of perfect in some ways that this year that he's had where he's been understated, right? Like, you think about the electricity about Pettersson's first season, and not that there weren't electric moments in year two, there absolutely were, but it was a more understated performance all around. Like, it was more mature. It was more consistent. It was more workmanlike in a lot of ways. The two-way results spiked enormously, even as the, you know, sort of frequency with which we saw those bar-down one-timers or just insane rush goals kind of evaporated as teams began to defend him differently. To have the playoff series he had and to still be, in my estimation, if not Vancouver's best player, and the only reason you wouldn't say he's their best player is that Quinn Hughes just was absolutely out of his mind, especially in games 2, 3, and 4. if not their best player, then right next to it, right? And, you know, he had a series where, as it went along, Dean Evason ran out of answers. Like, this is a 21-year-old center who was, we're saying, had a quiet series, right, from the outside looking in. And
right.
On the Minnesota Wild whiteboard, this 21-year-old pivot is already having the type of impact where the Wild coach spent time looking at his whiteboard, trying to come up with an answer, tried three different primary matchups for him at 5-on-5. None of them worked. You know what I mean? To be that type of player at 21, and then to come out of the series and we're like, there's more there. You know, like, that's not a sign of a guy who needs to give more. That's a sign of a dominant, dominant player who, even when they're not absolutely at the peak of their powers and shooting, you know, fireballs off their stick, they're still dominant in this league already. I mean, to me, that's just a massively positive sign and just fitting in a lot of ways, considering the season that Pettersson has had and some of the subtle ways that he's improved, you know, and provided surplus value to the Canucks far above and beyond his years and far above and beyond what he managed in his rookie season.
We're recording this a couple of days ahead of Game 1. Obviously, the preliminary round is now over. Teams have left the bubble. The Canucks had the option of packing up and moving from the Sutton Place to the J-Dub, and they decided not to, which Brandon Sutter said yesterday, we've got a Nintendo 64. That's all we really need.
So superstitious. Like, come on.
Yeah,
why do you think they didn't move?
No, I mean, and the Flames did, which I thought was interesting. And the Canucks decided that they were fine where they were. So, you know, maybe they're settling in for a long run here this summer. You know, there's lots of different ways to look at it, but you're right.
They are so superstitious. Everyone in hockey claims to not be superstitious and is so superstitious. The only guy in the Canucks room who will admit that they're superstitious is Bo Horvat. Everyone else is just like, it's not like I'm superstitious. And it's like, no, you guys are all nuts. All nuts across the board. 100%. Like Travis Green knocking on wood every time someone asked about the 5-on-5 goals. Right?
Right.
And I'm pretty sure he has a crisis tie. I've been meaning to bring this up. He has this like blue tie. If you go back and look at the tie that he was wearing in game two, it's like when there's a game he feels like he really needs to win, I feel like he wears the crisis tie. Just a passing observation, but something I've noticed and I think we should track through this playoffs. Like he's got this blue spotted tie. I think it's a crisis tie. I'm going to anoint it as being on watch, and I think we've got to pay attention to this. Hey, by the way, I just want to talk really quickly. Have you read Harmon Dial's latest at The Athletic yet?
Stuff has been coming so fast and furiously at me.
I know,
I'm not
crazy.
Even sure what his latest is. So
he's got a big deep dive piece on how analytics led Travis Green and the Canucks back to the playoffs. Lots of really interesting comments, an interview, one-on-one interview at length that Green gave to Dial during the pause, but that Harmon, because he's much more disciplined than me, saved for a high-interest point in time. You know, I would have read it the next day, right? Because I'm just like, I'll get more stories. It's fine. But Harmon's like calculating and smart, and he's written an absolute banger piece on how analytics has informed the Canucks' time off during the break, some of the video work guided by the numbers that the team did to upgrade their defensive system, something that, you know, looks to have paid off against the Wild, although we'll see if that lasts when the quality of the opponent turns up. I just really highly recommend that people go read it because it's tremendous insight into, you know, a coach who doesn't show that side of himself very often, but who's extremely conversant in some of the most contemporary ways of thinking about the game. Just absolutely, absolutely dynamite work from Mr. Harmon Dial.
All right. Well, I do look forward to checking that one out, and hopefully our VIPs will as well. Just as we move on, a couple of things. It's draft lottery day.
Yes.
We will drop predictions before we're done here on this very pod, so stick around for that. And I also saw where, it was rumored and probably long time coming, but Dale Tallon has been relieved of his duties in Florida, a place that and a person that you know well. So I want to get some thoughts there. But let's wrap up on the Western bubble, because you've been consumed with hockey in Edmonton, a situation unlike anything, and you're one of the few that, you know, has had this daily access. I mean, it's a Canucks podcast, and we hyper-focus on the Canucks, and rightly so, but You've had the chance, and you've written extensively about the sounds of the game and the things that you have picked up. I like the fact that Spectre told you to shut up. That made your column.
Well, it had to. It was too funny.
Yes.
You know, and look, Spectre and I go back, right? Like, we're very friendly.
I know. Somebody had to put you in your place.
No, for sure. I worked with Spec. My very first Sportsnet assignment traveling was the Canucks Flames series back the last time they were in the round of 16. And, you know, Spec could not have been more welcoming, more encouraging. Like, he took me out for beers the first night on assignment. Like, Spec is a great guy. You know, I'm not including that as a snide reference. I'm just including it because it was just so funny. And look, that was the point. The funniest sounds from the rink made the piece. I had to include that as well. The sounds of the game, I have one quick takeaway that I want to tell everyone, which is just that, and I've said this or variations of it before, but the team that's the loudest has won nearly every game I've seen. Whichever team has a higher energy level and keeps themselves better engaged on the bench seems to generate more momentum, more enthusiasm, seems to win the game. And I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg thing that you're naturally louder and more boisterous when you're winning or what have you, but something I've noticed, something that's been really pronounced from the experience in arena. The Flames, who did move to the JW, and good for them, they are the team that seems to have that down pat earliest. And on emotion alone, though I also think there's a variety of other reasons why they're a tough matchup for the Dallas Stars, on emotion alone, I do think the Flames are going to pose a major problem for their first round or their round of 16 opponent here in Dallas. The Golden Knights, okay, I noticed this. This is a thing I noticed. This is some super sleuth bullshit here, J-Pat. Ready? The NHL has scheduled it so that the only possible game on, it's Monday or Tuesday of next week, I think it's Tuesday of next week, would be a Game 5, if necessary, between Vegas and Chicago. And I read that like the league knowing exactly the measure of both of those teams. The league is counting on a day off for their staff on that Monday or that Tuesday. I really do need to double check it, but I think it's Tuesday. That Tuesday, the league is counting on a day off for their staff, and they have scheduled it accordingly in the expectation that the Vegas Golden Knights sweep. I think that's a good bet from the NHL. I'm looking forward to my day off too. The Arizona Coyotes, I think, I made some calls yesterday just to some pro scouts. Actually, you know what? I should drop this too. I made some calls to some pro scouts and some coaches, and one of the Eastern Conference pro scouts based in the West that I called said, you know, he agreed with my basic formulation that the Blues looked out of sorts, discombobulated, and he said, even without that, I think the Canucks are a really tough matchup for them just because of their top end skill. He said they've got three things. They're well coached. They've got really good goaltending. I think they have the better goaltending in this series, and they have a really good top end that'll give St. Louis trouble. That's enough that there's a real chance of an upset here. That's words from a very veteran, very bright NHL pro scout. This pro scout, however, also told me that he, in his estimation, Nashville was eliminated because of Darcy Kemper. Like, Darcy Kemper, the goaltender, right, won the series. I actually disagree with that. I think the Arizona Coyotes are Islanders West. I think they have a lot of speed up front. I think they actually, they give up a lot of shots. It doesn't look pretty, but the way that they limit quality in terms of the chances against, I think's real. I think they're an annoying team. I think they're a pain in the neck. I think Kemper was a big part of it, obviously, against the Predators, but I don't think that team's completely dead in the water. That said, this Colorado Avalanche team, no one has played with the type of focus that they have. This is Nathan MacKinnon's time. Like, he has the look of a guy who's just become obsessed with winning. I think that's going to be a short series too. And really, really the interest is going to be in that 4-5 and that 5 and that 6-3 matchup in this Western bracket. Luckily, both those games involve Canadian teams, should make for some fun hockey watching in the week ahead.
All right. I'll get your thoughts on Dale Tallon here in a sec, but first a word from our friends at Indochino. All right, let's get into this, because you worked in Florida under Dale Tallon the last bunch of years before making your way back to the West Coast and joining The Athletic and covering the Canucks as you have done all season long. But you're still tapped in Florida. You got lots of friends in the organization. And I know that you've been keeping close tabs on what's gone on there and what's gone wrong. And you know, obviously they get punted in the play-in by the New York Islanders, didn't put up a huge fight in the elimination game. You know, there's lots of component parts. You know that better than most, but for whatever reason, they just haven't been able to sort of put it together and get over any kind of hump. And so a lot of the storylines that have dogged the franchise for a while still exist, and yet it's going to be on the watch of a new general manager. What do you make of the dismissal of Dale Tallon?
Yeah, look, it was time, right? Like, it had been 10 years. The team's made the playoffs twice. They've never won a round, right? They've developed, they drafted well in the first 4 years, but since 2000, the last draft pick on their roster to play a major role was Aaron Ekblad. The only other guy on the roster was Riley Stillman since 2014. Like, that was Jim Benning's first draft as general manager, right? Think about that. Think about how we talk about Jim, right? Think about how we talk about Mike Gillis's draft record, right? And there's more NHLers that have come in Gillis's 6 years, right? Than have come for the Florida Panthers in their most recent 6 years, right? And what happens if you're a small market team that doesn't draft well? Well, you end up having to rely on free agents, right? Like, you end up having to flesh out your roster in other ways that are, you know, potentially really harmful to your club's sustainable business interests when you're not generating the type of revenue that, you know, we've been used to seeing the Canucks generate, for example, right? You know, you look at how Anton Strahlman played in that qualifying round. And then you consider that, you know, Jason Demers, for example, who was traded by the Panthers, they're still, you know, Jason Demers is still on the Panthers payroll, right? Well, he played 24 minutes, had 2 assists, and was +3 in a game in which his team advanced, right? Like, there's no Florida Panthers defender who was as good defensively, frankly, there's no defender on the Panthers payroll who had as good a qualifying round series as Jason Demers, right? I've seen Riley Smith and Jonathan Marchessault play live 3 times in this sort of last 10 days. And, you know, you think about what the Panthers look like if they've got those two instead of Brett Connolly and, you know, whomever. I mean, Mike Hoffman played well in that Panthers series. I like Mike Hoffman as a player. Evgeny Dadonov's tremendous. But nonetheless, like, you know, you didn't have to be an either or necessarily, right? Like, you could have had Marchessault and Riley Smith on your second or third line. Vinny Trocheck in Carolina. You know, James Reimer outperformed Sergei Bobrovsky this season. The Panthers took on Scott Darling's contract and bought it out to create the space to sign a $10 million goalie, signed for 6 more years, who was outperformed by the guy they had on staff for $3.2 million. Right?
Like, that is crazy.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's no secret. I don't think philosophically Dale Tallon would ever be a match for me anyway, in terms of how we view life in the game and people and on and on. And there was a stylistic clash during my time there. Overall, you know, I'm not surprised by this. I think it was clearly time. I think that organization has a lot of work to do to untie a variety of these, you know, significant and inefficient contractual commitments that they're in and rebuild a prospect system effectively that just has nothing there. You know, I mean, you like Spencer Knight, you like, you know, Denisenko and on, but it's like, they really need to start developing NHL players in house and like at least one a year. You can't have 5 years of black hole drafting. Like, it kills you. It just completely slays you, especially when you're a team with those types of margins. There's a lot of work to do to get that franchise back on track. Not all of it's on the hockey side. I root for a lot of the people in that organization. I know a lot of them are close to Dale, and, you know, I feel for them today. I'm sure it's not an easy day in that organization for a lot of the people that I care about and who I work closely with. You know, overall, I don't want to be unclassy here, you know, in terms of Dale himself. But I just don't know that the relatively insular way that he managed things, it works in a contemporary NHL. You know, I do think it needs to be a little more collaborative. You need to build people up and trust them a little bit more. There's just too much work to do in an NHL organization for all of the yes-no decisions to fall on one guy. And, you know, we'll sort of see what happens next. But I do wish the best for the Panthers. I do hope that they land a really good general manager here. I think there's some really strong candidates. Like, there's some really smart people around the league. You know, you obviously think about a guy like Chris McFarland in Colorado, who reportedly interviewed for that New Jersey Devils job. Lawrence Gilman was a finalist for that New Jersey Devils job. There's definitely some teams that have come knocking on Chris Drury, New York Rangers assistant general manager, who's done a pretty tremendous job as that club really leaned into a quick rebuild. I think there's going to be some good options for the Panthers to discuss. I think it's good that they're bringing in an external voice, you know, in Dale's wake. I think that's the right play. We'll sort of see where this ends up. But yeah, that's my sort of quick blush reaction. And, you know, I just, it's hard to look at the record over the last 10 years, especially. But even if you want to just look at the last four since he came back, following, you know, the 6 months when he was punted upstairs, as it were, you know, I just don't think there's enough juice there to really defend. It hasn't worked out for the organization, and it's set a franchise that didn't have a ton of margin for error back. So a lot of work to be done now.
Yeah, and I mean, what an incredible situation it could be for whoever gets that job as GM. I mean, could walk in with the first overall pick in the draft, right? Like, the Panthers are one of the eight teams that are in the mix that'll have the lotto balls. We spent a podcast earlier, you know, where you gave us the play-by-play of being in that room where the lottery balls are actually drawn, and that's done for television purposes. But this thing, my understanding is the draft lotto is going to be eight balls in the hopper.
Eight balls with logos in the gravity pit.
Live television. I love it. Like, that's the way that, you know, for the reasons that I think there are people that still don't understand sort of how many permutations there are to get down to the normal lottery. It can't really be done on live TV, but this is eight balls, equal odds across the board, logo them up, get them going, and may the best team. It's going to be fast, but it's going to be fantastic television.
The quick turnaround with the one like lottery ball artist who just had to stencil on the Toronto Maple Leafs logo last night. I love that. There's a story
right
there.
Well, let's finish up with our predictions then of where we think this is going to go. I mean, obviously everybody's got thoughts of where it can't go. It can't happen for Edmonton again. People don't want it to happen for Toronto. Pittsburgh obviously has had its star power, but, you know, I mean, you just laid out a pretty compelling case. I don't know what Alexis Lafreniere would do for, you know, the Florida market and engagement and fan interest, but, you know, we're talking about adding a legitimate top liner to a team that already's got a bunch. I'm going to say Florida does win it. I know not much has gone the Florida Panthers' way on the ice. You just laid it all out there. I'm going to say Florida wins this thing, and there's a part of me that's hoping that that is in fact the case.
All right. I think in a just world, the Winnipeg Jets would win it, right? You think about how they lost Scheifele, Brian Little, Patrick Laine, Kevin Hayes, Tyler Myers, Dustin Byfuglien, Ben Chiarot, Jacob Trouba, right? Like, they've lost all this high-end talent to injury and to departures and to a guy not wanting to be in Canada because his, you know, partner's pursuing a medical career, and, you know, on and on. And I don't think you'd second guess any of those moves, right? Like, they've lost a top line and a top four worth of talent without making a single thing that I think you'd call a hockey management mistake. To me, in a just world, the Winnipeg Jets would win it. Of course, we do not live in a just world, J-Pat, so they will not win it.
No, we do not.
My pick is the Minnesota Wild. Maximum chaos.
Oh,
Canucks
God.
Fans pulling their hair out. Judd Brackett with a first overall pick. Let's go.
They don't need Judd Brackett if they've got the first overall pick. They can hire me as their head scout at that point.
Minnesota Wild. It's too funny. It's too funny. And you know.
Storylines for days
and here,
and
I
years.
And I want to get out ahead of this. The Minnesota Wild are for sure going to win the draft lottery. But to console Canucks fans, I just want to assure you not to worry. If it had been the Canucks logo on that ball in the gravity pick, the Canucks wouldn't have won it anyway.
No, I know. And yet people will hold to that forever. They'll take that to their grave.
I know.
It's totally parallel universe
stuff.
There's
no way. There's no way it's not going to be the Wild, J-Pack. We know this, right?
All right. Well, we'll all be watching later on today, and we'll all be watching Wednesday when the Canucks get her going against the St. Louis Blues. We'll continue to pump out pods here a couple of times a week. Again, we try not to go on game day, so we'll let you know on social media when we're firing up the podcaster, and we'll be here throughout the series breaking it down. And getting Thomas's insight on what's going on inside that Edmonton bubble. If you need more to feed your hockey thirst and hunger here during the playoffs, now that the playoffs are underway. Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun have two-man advantage Wednesday morning as they set the table for the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs here at The Athletic. And don't forget, rate and subscribe to the VanCast on Apple. On to the postseason. Well, the playoffs. Officially the playoffs now for the Vancouver Canucks for the first time since 2015. Looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun. There's buy-in in this city. You can feel it on Friday night in the aftermath of the Canucks overtime win over the Wild. So bring on the Blues. We'll see about getting Brett Hull on. Grease him up a little bit. And maybe he can sing a few tunes for us here as we go through this series. For Drancer, it's J-Pat. As always, thanks for your support. Thanks for listening to the VanCast here at The Athletic and TheAthletic.com.